So the history of extended piano techniques, I will take a look at two little case studies and then come to some conclusions. Now the history of extended piano techniques, of course you know, we've been talking about such things for a few days now, is more about which history of extended techniques, and then first of all, what are actually extended piano techniques. It's a bit of a problem because the existing definitions are mostly popular. They're about non-traditional techniques, unconventional, inappropriate, and, well, we've heard that as well. Whose tradition, what kind of conventions, and how inappropriate do you want to be, or could you be with these techniques? So they don't really lead us far, and I'll actually show you that there is, in fact, a long tradition of these techniques, much longer than we expected, and there are plenty of conventions. The literature is ample, but all written by performers, and they don't have the reflex to delineate their subject and to talk about what the terminology really means to them. And you have some paradoxes with books that, for instance, on extended violin techniques, the one book talks about collegno, the other one doesn't. There's a book on extended flute techniques, one book considers live electronics to be part of that, another one doesn't. So what should we investigate in the history? And then composers write about these techniques in their scores, but they don't really look at the techniques of the performer, they look at the sound effect. And that's not always the case for the performer. That technique and effect is in fact the same thing. So I looked at the properties of extended techniques and... In the literature, when you compare them, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of books on extended techniques for almost every instrument of the orchestra, the voice also. And when we compare those, we can deduce that it's basically all about improprieties of the instrument. Improprieties not in the sense that is associated with any moral standard, that in the sense of you shouldn't play that way, although that's, of course, one of the concepts that is pervading these techniques, but more in the etymological sense, not according to the properties of the instrument, that is, for what the instrument was conceived to make sound. If improper piano playing is extended techniques, then what is proper piano playing? Because we need to define that first. It's very funny that there is no definition on piano playing. There's not even a definition on the piano. It may seem futile because everybody will recognize that, but is a synthesizer, is that a piano? Is a pianoforte a piano? When you look in dictionaries or encyclopedias, they will start straight away with the history. But again, we don't really know where to look then. So I thought of what piano playing is, and I will demonstrate that to you. You may laugh, I'll let it sink in. This is piano playing. This is revolutionary, because it says now what this instrument is made for, and it goes pretty far. So one finger on one key, vertically articulated. That means, all the rest of course is improper playing, that means that gliding is an improper piano technique. Again, please do not think about these connotations of what the tradition should say, what you should do at an instrument. Of course you can glide over the keys, but if it had been made specifically to glide, well, they would have probably not had a difference between the black and the white keys. And that's again pretty simple and futile, but when you consider further that playing on the inside of the piano, of course, is improper to what the instrument was made for, you can't really access it that well as you can access the keys. So if improper piano playing is anything and everything that is not this action, then of course the cluster, the glissando, string playing, the bowed piano is improper. Half pedals. You need to think this through, but if the pedal really was meant to be used halfway or a quarter way, we would need to find out when we're there. It's like driving a car and using your left foot for the gas and your right foot for the brake. You will find out very soon that that's not a good way to do because you don't know where you are with your feet. Nevertheless, many scores use quarter pedals. Touche bloquée, which means just to depress the key silently and then you can play on it, but you don't get a sound, used a lot. Excuse me, one finger on two notes, used quite a lot, especially with the thumb. And then, of course, two fingers on one note, 19th century classical technique, but in the case of this type of definition, it's something we should look for. And then a prepared piano, which is properly played at the keyboard, but the pianist needs to do some actions that interfere with the proper sound producing aspects of this instrument. Same with electronics. If the performer uses them, like the original version of Stockhausen's Mantra, where the pianist plays and has to turn the dial, which involves some virtuosity of its own, is in proper piano technique. But if there's some technician in the hall who does all the electronics, then it wouldn't be in proper extended performance technique. There are secondary techniques. I would normally come up, bow, and be seated. Instrumental theater uses those performance techniques, elaborates on them, and extends them. There, of course, the extremes. The piano is not made to not play upon. That means 433 by Cage involves extended techniques, and that's another vision of what normally the piece is being thought of. And then, of course, burn the piano, destroy it, throw it from a balcony. All existing pieces, you may again laugh, but as a pianist, I'm asked to play this piece. I'm asked to play Lamont Young in a festival. I have to feed the piano hay. How does one do that? Do you also feed it water? Do you also give it straw? When has it eaten? When does it decide not to eat? And that's the end of the piece. Those are techniques to investigate, and where do they come from? So, of course, as a researcher, I have to take these things very seriously. So the case studies, the cluster, this is the first cluster that I could find, 1724. It doesn't look like one, but when you read the preface, the composer says to hit the lowest notes of the keyboard with the flat and the complete length of the hand. Again, that's the canon shot there. You can either play it as a C major chord, if you're more inspired, and you could just play a cluster. This is a very different way of notating the cluster in 1738. You can see it's a straightforward Roman numeral notation, but it says fort, and it's actually saying violent in the text. Now, on a harpsichord, there's no such thing as violent because all the notes are equal. They don't sound soft or loud, they sound the same. And I've been told by harpsichord players when they play this chaos piece, the beginning of the Big Bang, they use the flat of the hand. This is another one. Here you see around 1750 already the notation that we're used to, or close to it. You also see that he uses clusters on different notes, and he will integrate them harmonically. Here plays simultaneously all the notes that are in the interval of the two notes, regardless of sharps or flats. So it's a chromatically filled. With the first one, he says, play the lowest notes. So it was a C major chord, but he has to play the lowest notes. This is how Fouquet then uses it. He uses clusters in A major, in G major, in E flat major. Doesn't make much of a difference because, again, this is a harpsichord piece. And all these notes are just as loud, so you don't really hear this differentiation. But they try to integrate it in their tonal language. And this friction between how you play it, how long the length of your hand would be, and then how you should try and make it sound like an A major chromatic cluster, this friction is already there. Here also, Balbat pour la canonade. In the 1970s, a similar piece by this composer with this notation was thought to represent a glissando. It's in fact a cluster. It's not very clear whether this should be an Aeolian cluster or a chromatic or a minor or a major cluster. In fact, when you compare it to the context, it's fully chromatic. Important about this piece is that it's the first piano cluster. All piano pieces with clusters in that century were about canon shots. Now, if you perform that on the harpsichord, your canon shot will just stop like it doesn't in real life. On the piano with the pedal, it has a decay, and it sounds more natural. But a more important aspect of this little piece is that it goes again pretty far in trying to integrate it tonally. You see there how there are some musket shots. You have the diminished in those days, and then on top of that, a full chromatic cluster. This is an integration that we won't see for another two centuries. It took until the 1970s before composers again try to have all these extended techniques fit in a language that also uses proper techniques. Of course, performers, practically speaking, one starts to wonder about these canon shots that are just notated as an octave, what they would have done. I don't think they would have played just an F major, an F octave, if they knew that many pieces were being played with the flat of the hand. And here we see that the two hands should be used flat on the three lower octaves. Now, regardless of where the octave goes, the three lower octaves are three octaves. Lots of these pieces, if not most, were used for domestic purposes, played by women. I don't know, I can't touch three octaves with my two hands. So there's again this friction with what is being written, an embodied technique or something that should fit a tonal language. Here we have Quand je joue avec le tonnerre, the thunder. I just show that because the piano clusters stop at 1816 when Napoleon was chased out of the country that would become my home country. The organ clusters in the 18th century were all used in the Judex Crederis improvisations in the Te Deum. And that's a tradition that goes on to today. In Switzerland, you have churches where the organ players still use clusters like they used in the 18th century. We jump to Henry Cowell's Musical Resources, where he writes about how in medieval times, chords consisted of two notes, tonal times, triads, then jazz, four notes, and then it was a logical evolution that he would now write with clusters. And he tried to make a theory, for instance, building chords out of clusters instead of out of notes, building melodies with clusters, and even contrapuntal lines. Now, the funny thing is that none of this is in any of his pieces. So he theorized, but didn't use it. On the other way, his 900 and some manuscripts at the Library of Congress have thousands, if not more than thousands, of clusters, and they're all based on the length of a body part, hand, the fist, the forearm, etc. Never on any of these theories. So again, this friction. And it goes on with Stockhausen serializing the cluster, not by the notes of the density, but by the length, again, of a body part. About the glissando, it's important to note that the word didn't come into scores before the 1820s. Glissando, the word, is basically an indication of a fingering. If there's a C major scale, you do not know, in principle, whether you should play like this or just by gliding. Of course, there's tradition and there are exceptions. But still, when you look at something at a score, you don't always know. This is the first official glissando that I could find, 1753 or a bit before that, and it asks to play these runs with the nail of the second finger. I think that's very clear. That's one way of notating it. I have not found a second one like this. Another one was Scarlatti, who wrote three sonatas with glissandi, condotto solo, with one finger. They're all in F major, by the way, also all the glissando, so the B flat didn't matter too much. And I hope that it will. Okay, this is another way, just the same fingering all over. This is Mozart's variations in an edition of 1803 when he published his Waldstein Sonata where he used the same kind of fingering. So it was kind of a convention there. And in the original score, we would still have the metric divisions of 128 notes. Mozart never anywhere else used such a fast notation for the small notes. So the speed can be an indication. Sometimes it's pretty obvious that you should glide. I don't know if I need to explain this. When the guillotine drops during the French Revolution, gliding is of course much more attractive. But it's less self-evident when you just see these notes. This is presto assai. I don't think after four bars you could just stop, have a finale to individually articulate all these notes at the end. And the slur may in fact be one of the conventions to notate the articulation of a glissando. But I want to come to this piece. I'm sure most of you will know this highly trio. It should sound like this. This is about an allegro tempo. I wouldn't go much slower because at the end you have this half cadence. And if you go any slower, it just doesn't make sense because it drags. We have a serious problem when we look at the second theme. I'll play this. I can't play that like that, and nobody does. They all slow down either right when that starts, or in the bridge, or from the start. But I was taught never to compromise a tempo if your technical abilities weren't up to scratch. So, these are glissandos, octave glissandos. Now, there's a whole context about that. There's different ways of proving that they're glissandos. I will skip all that to come to something more important for today. You can see that he decided on the white notes he could write octaves when it repeats, but not, of course, when there's an F sharp, because you cannot glide so easily towards the F sharp. Now, if we put the theme in the exposition and the recapitulation next to one another, I actually think we can see that the original version of that theme is the one in recapitulation, where you have and then the variation with all the octaves ending with a long octave glissando. But because he couldn't do it in G major, he couldn't do that there with the F sharps, he just decided to change it. Now, why didn't he write it the other way around? Why not the original version, which I call the original version, in C major in the beginning? That would have been more logical. At the beginning, the theme is original, and then after in the recapitulation, it would have undergone some changes. It's because then it would have been in C major, but then the trio, the first movement, would have been in F major, and then the second theme in the recapitulation would be in F major, and then you would have many more B flats in those motifs than you have these three F sharps, and they would be in the middle of the glissandi. So I think this shows how the use of this technique, which he used in other works as well, define how he developed his sonata form. And I'll just have you listen to it. I show this because this is a copy of a Viennese instrument, but nobody plays these when they play them on pianofortes on a Viennese, because it was believed, we still have no proof, that Haydn wrote this while he was in England. It was dedicated to Therese Jansen, a famous English pianist, so of course it would be written for an English instrument. But you can't play this on an English instrument, because just like these instruments, the English had a heavier action. The key depth was deeper, the chamfering was more sharp. It doesn't work on most of these English instruments. So my take would be, yes, there were glissandos, but he still had all his experience with Viennese instruments, and it's not said that the composer moves to another country and then just adapts to all the instruments over there. He still has his ways. Well, I'm listening to the original. Now, this is a crude recording. I made this just like that. But I think I can also demonstrate that the idea of a cheap technique, and I've gotten a lot of flack from performers to dare say that Haydn would have used something as cheap as this. Of course, then they stop talking about humor in Haydn. That's another matter. But I think this is actually a much more subtle technique. You can't do with individual wrist articulation what you can do with a glissando. You can articulate the phrasing. You can start heavy on the first note. You can actually lift your hand after the glissando to come out on each eighth note, etc. You can do many things with that. So the conclusions, of course, there are impacts on performance practice of this research. On the terminology, we now have an idea, if not one of several, of what extended techniques are or could be, or what one extended technique would be. How much is it an extension of a technique? On piano playing as well. Of course, the theory of techniques needs to be revised a little bit. The current or the existing cluster techniques do not match the history of the phenomenon at all. The same goes for the glissando. There's quite a lot to be said about glissando, but also other techniques, pedal techniques, sympathetic resonance. Think of the flageolet, the clavier flageolet by Schoenberg. It's not a flageolet sound, and we have a flageolet. When you press an overtone on the string and you hit the relevant key, you get a real flageolet, but we don't have a name for that. So composers write texts to explain what you should do, whereas there might just be just a word. And then, of course, the impact on theory, the analysis, like I showed with the Haydn. It also goes for the cluster, when we think of Stockhausen serializing. Again, the pedals that were serialized by Boulez, but nobody writes about them. We still think that the pedals were added after the rest of the piece was written, because that's something you would do practically. What if they were also serialized then? I think there's enough proof to say that some composers serialized them, but then it becomes another matter for performers. Because how seriously should you take the most difficult ones if you see that you can't perform it and you know it was a matrix determining the pedal markings? And then, of course, for today, the history of techniques ends up with a different canonization. The Balbatre piece came out of an obscure collection of the daughter of the first American president. Paris doesn't even have the piece. Nobody would pay attention to it if you just look at a canonization based on innovation in form, innovation in how to approach different aspects and not look to the techniques. And of course, for me, also of piano playing. For me, as many other people, the 19th century is a high point of piano playing. We have Schumann, Liszt, Brahms, Chopin. But when you look at the 18th century and you see that except for prepared piano, of course, live electronics, and boat piano, everything was tried already then. I have amazing pieces from the 1790s that play on the inside of the piano, flageolets in sixth, integrated in the sonata form, that has, even outside of these techniques, the quality of an early Mozart sonata. When you look at that, and the diversity of the experiments with the sound on the early piano, and then the 20th century, with the 19th century in between, the 19th century actually becomes a much more dull century. It's not a high point, it's a bit of a dip. Don't get me wrong, I still love Schumann, Chopin, Brahms, and Liszt. But as we've said about these teleological ways of writing history, this is another landscape on the history of piano repertoire and its extended techniques. Thank you.
Very much indeed, Luke. I'm sure there will be some questions. Yes.
Just a question of ignorance. I got the impression that those extended piano techniques were developed by French keyboard players. Is it correct or not?
Well, that's a good question. If I understand it correctly, and you refer to the 18th century, it's true that the canon clusters were French. In Germany, in Vienna, they had another way. They had these little bells and these little drums underneath the piano. And we see that in plenty of scores, they use the same notation, the X with a circle around it. Beethoven Wellington's piece for piano uses that. Of course, Vienna, Turkey, you know, Janissary music. It wasn't the case in France. But yeah, the case could be made for the sense of experimentation with color in Paris much more than in Vienna from this point of view.
Other questions? Yes.
Franz, in his Paganini variations, also has used his octave glissando. Do you know how to play it?
Yes.
Yes, just like this.
But remind yourself of what type of piano they had. I mean, the glissando, the 19th century is, for piano playing in general, the age of the keyboard. That's what they investigated. In terms of extended techniques, there were no inside piano playing experiments. There were no clusters. Liszt got very close to it with just one chord in Lohage, which he wrote after he heard this organ recital in Switzerland with clusters. It's just he didn't dare go that far. Otherwise, it's all glissandos. But you see a very, very, it's nice to use the metaphor of glissando for that sense, because you see a boom until about 1860, and then it drops, because the key dip and the weight of the action becomes so cumbersome for pianists that they just don't write, these pianist composers don't write these glissandos anymore. So this Brahms, of course, shouldn't be played on a Bösendorf of the year 2012. But if you play it on an instrument of that time, it's actually not difficult at all. And you can see how also in other pieces he uses typical Brahms symmetry. Now this is the easy way to play octaves. This is more difficult. Well, it's how they are used.
You mentioned as an example for the clusters formed for most mood pieces, something like Canonade, Battaglia, perhaps. And you have one example of Scarlatti. Was this Rani sonata or?
Those were only glissandos. So Scarlatti wrote three sonatas. They're not early, no?
So you have these clusters only in mood pieces?
Well, I haven't found a cluster in glissando in Scarlatti. Of course, when you think of something very different, the accacciatura, that's not a cluster to my definition, because that's just proper fingering.
Okay.
A cluster would be the use of the hand or any other buttock part except for those vertical fingerings.
I was thinking on the point that if we have this concentration in a certain kind of genre, it's not so far away from the history of genre, but with another emphasizing.
Yes. It's true. The cluster was only in these salon pieces. Yeah. I mean, the Canonade by Barbat is a refined version of a typical battle piece, and I would not play these battle pieces for you. They're very boring, and you have to wait endlessly for all these very primitive tonal evolution, and then there's a fermata, and then you hear this cluster, and that's it. Well, Bartra is much more interesting, but still it's in that one genre.
Yeah.
The glissando had a boom at the end of the 18th century where it became perhaps not fashionable, but at least you notice it being used in all genres, not just the concerto, but also sonatas. So in the beginning, that also was used in a lot of programmatic pieces, like blowing up a ship in a battle piece. Just you see the pieces flying up in the air with this glissando that's being used. At the end of the 18th century, you see it in chamber music, the Haydn, you see it in concertos, in all types of genres.
I'm wondering slightly if, I mean, could this be broadened conceptually in the sense that, you know, it's not unique to extended piano techniques to find music that is composed against the grain of the instrument, if you like. Maybe not in this extreme form, but I mean, a feature of virtuosity, the history of virtuosity, is partly a history of composing against the grain of what the instrument wants to do. And in that sense, the relationship between performer and instrument is right at the center of it. I mean, have you kind of thought of it in those terms?
Yes, and when it comes to that, it's basically only clear in the 19th century, when they start to concentrate on the keyboard and they decide this is piano playing. In the 18th century, you can see them with these techniques, thinking about, okay, what can we do with this instrument? What should you do? What is proper to do? They discover that with this cluster technique, you can play cannon shots. I mean, in all these other battle pieces, also the Balbatre, you hear the stampede of the horses. You hear gun shots. You hear the wounded soldiers crying. You have all these programmatic stylistic aspects, and then the cluster is one of them. But with the glissando, you can see indeed that they work with the instrument and sometimes against. The 19th century is much more with. The instrument evolves and the glissandos disappear. In the 18th century, you don't have that. But it wasn't very clear yet whether they should play still on a harpsichord or the organ or the clavichord or the piano. And that's why you see these pieces sometimes not being written for anything specific, also with these techniques.
Final question, did you have
any? A short remark. It might be a fine combination to do with, to your perspective. For example, Carl Czerny in his Klavierschule, I think it's the third or fourth part of it, über den musikalischen Vortrag, or similar. He remarks that the art of playing, one has to play like that you can see it from far away. You have to understand of, by seeing the player. And that might be kind of addition.
Oh, true, yes. We all know the first piano concerto by Beethoven with this octave glissando, which there's still a dispute going on. The ones that say, well, it must be, of course, a glissando, but it's too slow, even for those instruments. The momentum never really gains. So what did he do? But you can envisage Beethoven coming out on the scene in Bonn and then in Vienna, wanting to make an impression, and with his stature, and his known playing, which was a bit brutish sometimes, just at the end of the development section, when the orchestra just kind of fades out, and then he just glides over that keyboard. That's something that you must see. It was intended to show, look, this is what I dare do in this moment. And then it doesn't become so much a question, okay, you have one bar for this glissando, and that's actually too much. He just hit that top note and went to the bottom, and the conductor ended up with him. So it's something very visual, I guess.
Good. Well, once again, thank you very much indeed.